Hi, and welcome to Convergence. I'm Ellen Taylor, alongside my co-host, Michelle MacLoon. We do a deep dive into issues of culture and faith. And once again, Michelle's joining me from lockdown in Germany. Holding up well, Michelle?
It's getting a little frail. It's getting a little thin over here. But we're enduring.
I feel like our conversations each week, is it brings you a moment of sanity in your lockdown.
It does.
Cold
it does.
World.
You bring me sanity, Ellen. Yeah, you do.
Good. Well, we've got a great guest lined up for today as we take a deeper look at some issues that maybe on the surface we think we know about, but we really don't. We welcome in Erica Bakiaki, a legal scholar with the Wollstonecraft Project at the Abigail Adams Institute at Harvard University. Right there, that's a mouthful. The Wollstonecraft Project, it aims to facilitate and support scholarly engagement in questions of sexual equality and freedom. And so bringing that in to explain all that is, we're going to bring in Erica. Good morning, Erica.
Hi there. It's good to be with you both.
And how do we pronounce that? It's Wollstonecraft?
I say Wollstonecraft.
Let's go ahead and start, because you're at the Abigail Adams Institute in Harvard University. What is this specific project that you are working on? And who was Wollstonecraft? There we go. Who was the lady?
Yes. So I have been doing legal work in the area of especially abortion jurisprudence, but also sex discrimination law, for some time now. And I have a book coming out of Notre Dame University Press called The Rights of Women: Reclaiming a Lost Vision, which actually builds on the work of Mary Wollstonecraft, who is an 18th century British philosopher who is very well known for her work, The Vindication of the Rights of Women, which is where my title comes from, of course. And she's a very interesting woman, in part because, well, for a Catholic audience, you should know she's no saint. Although when she wrote this this kind of singular piece on women's rights and sort of the cause of women's rights and the rationale for women's rights, she was 33, hadn't met a man that she would embrace later. After writing this piece, she had some difficulties in the life of love. And so sometimes those things were kind of brought her down, and she wasn't considered for her political and moral theory until really 100 years after she died. And so with the emergence of women scholars in political theory and philosophy especially, we've seen sort of a new interest in her work that is really, interestingly, I think, coincident also with this emergence of virtue ethics in the academy, which is a great thing. when academics start talking about virtue again, we think that they've given up on maybe other things and looked back at, you know, the real beginnings of the great Western canon with Aristotle. And so I would think of her as really an Aristotelian moral philosopher. And what she brings to the table, and I think is really important in the question of women's rights today, is that she argued for women's rights with an explicit end in mind. So today we think of women's rights as sort of, you know, women kind of, I don't know, just asserting any right they want. So now, of course, the most fundamental right women seem to think that they have is a right to take the life of their own child. And, you know, that's where I got started. And because that made no sense to me, I really wanted to go back to understand how women's rights advocates in the past had understood rights themselves. And so when you start with Mary Wollstonecraft, you see that for her, she understood rights to be grounded in pre-existing duties. So we're not first and foremost beings with rights. We're first and foremost beings who have interweaving obligations to one another, and most especially our obligations to those who need us most, which is in our family. So it really would make no sense to her, and she was pretty explicit about this, that women would have a right to abortion because their rights were necessary so that they could live out and, be true to those pre-existing obligations, first and foremost to their families. And same with men too, that men have rights so that they could carry out their obligations to their families and to, you know, other obligations that they might have to society at large.
Okay, you talk about
gender equality, but you actually explain it in a very succinct way that feminism, gender equality, can only be discussed when you talk about reproductive asymmetry. What are you talking about? What is, explain that to our listeners. It's really an interesting point.
Yeah, so I actually came back to the church after having, well, I grew up in a very broken home, came back through the 12 steps, and then find myself really questioning things like abortion even before I came back to the church. So I was a very pro-choice feminist for some time. And so when I came back to the church, I loved all the teachings on women. And of course, on the life issues, but I wasn't particularly satisfied with kind of how we got to them, I guess I would say. Like, I wanted to get a bit more to the root questions that feminists have, because I feel like I have a moral responsibility to build a bridge to people like myself, those who I think are well-intentioned and really want to help women and children, but are kind of on the wrong path. And so in a lot of my work is really trying to build a bridge by understanding their questions the way they sort of understand them. And so for me, the core issue, the really kind of deepest issue that I think we just have different answers to is the one of reproductive asymmetry. And that's basically all it is to say is that when men and women engage in the same sexual act, there are very different consequences for men and women. And so men have, the capacity, I guess, if they want to be irresponsible about it, to walk away from an unintended pregnancy. Women, because Aristotle would say, they reproduce within themselves rather than, you know, as contributing from without, they don't have the capacity to walk away from an unintended pregnancy. They have to engage in an affirmative and destructive act. And so those acts are incredibly different. And so to try to say that, and this is really the most popular claim of abortion rights feminists right now, is that women, in order for women to be equal to men, they have to have this right to take the life of their child. But the equality is built on something so spurious. I mean, it's this idea that women should be equal to irresponsible men who are walking away from their children, but by doing something that is entirely different from walking away, which is actually engaging in private killing or asking, you know, paying an abortionist to do so. And so there's really no equality there. The much better way to think about equality is actually how Wollstonecraft and the early American women's rights advocates who followed her, which is to say, if you want to see equality in the reproductive act, bring men up to the responsibility that women have. Of course, men will never be able to have children, but they can engage in, you know, very engaged and attentive fathering, both by caring for the mother of their child, but also caring for their children in the way that great fathers and great men do.
You know, Erica, I think you put that very simply. That seems a very noble end to have, where we're not going to goad it down to the lower level of abandonment and getting rid of a problem. We're going to ask society or men to rise up to the level of solving the problem without doing harm or killing or anything that is sinful for us as people of faith, but also kind of goes against your moral conscience, even if you're not a religious person. So that idea seems like it should be agreed upon in circles that discuss this. Do you find that that is an opinion or an argument, if you say that, that is welcome? Or what kind of response do you get when you put forth that perspective?
Yeah, you know, I think whether or not you ascribe to the word, it's really, you know, probably depends a lot on people's own backgrounds and things like that. I definitely understand the repellency to the word, because in light of, you know, those who are, you know, the most vocal feminists out there are very much see abortion rights as the center of their platform. And really, you know, I think you're right that the militancy has gotten worse, where abortion is really considered this kind of positive good, which would be, you know, abhorrent to a person, again, like Wollstonecraft or some of the early American women's rights advocates. I tend to talk more about women's rights advocates, and I use that language more. Pro-life feminist is a quick way to sort of get at what I'm getting at. And so sometimes I use that language as well. But I think one of the reasons why I've kept the term, well, a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, John Paul II, in his encyclicals about women, really called for Catholic women to sort of rewrite feminism, to understand or create, envision a new feminism that doesn't take kind of models of male domination as, you know, the way forward, sort of imitation of those kind of models, doesn't take power to be the most kind of essential thing. And so that's why I've really learned a lot from care feminists who have kind of critiques of that sort of way of moving forward. I also think it's helpful because I don't know of another way of getting to this this issue that I mentioned before of asymmetry, that there really are different issues that women have by just because of being those who reproduce within ourselves, you know, that we're responsible for the children, for our children in the womb. And then we're responsible generally for children when they're very young because of nursing and because of the desire that most women, many women have to nurture their very young children. So there's a way in which because what men and women are different, that we can't just, you know, there's got to be a word that helps us to understand that disproportionate burden and privilege that women have. And I think kind of a pro-life feminism, you know, can get us there. But I can definitely understand why people don't find that appealing as well.
Where do you see the discussion about feminism today?
Yeah, you know, I think whether or not you ascribe to the word is really, right, you know, probably depends a lot on people's own backgrounds and things like that. I definitely understand the repellency to the word because in light of, you know, those who are, you know, the most vocal feminists out there are very much see abortion rights as the center of their platform. And really, you know, I think you're right that the militancy has gotten worse where abortion is really considered this kind of positive good, which would be, you know, abhorrent to a person, again, like Wollstonecraft or some of the early American women's rights advocates. I tend to talk more about women's rights advocates, and I use that language more. Pro-life feminist is a quick way to sort of get at what I'm getting at. And so sometimes I use that language as well. But I think one of the reasons why I've kept the term, well, a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, John Paul II, in his encyclicals about women, really called for Catholic women to sort of rewrite feminism, to understand or create, envision a new feminism that doesn't take kind of models of male domination as, you know, the way forward, sort of imitation of those kind of models, doesn't take power to be the most kind of essential thing. And so that's why I've really learned a lot from care feminists who have kind of critiques of that sort of way of moving forward. I also think it's helpful because I don't know of another way of getting to this this issue that I mentioned before of asymmetry, that there really are different issues that women have by just because of being those who reproduce within ourselves, you know, that we're responsible for the children, for our children in the womb. And then we're responsible generally for children when they're very young because of nursing and because of the desire that most women, many women have to nurture their very young children. So there's a way in which because what men and women are different, that we can't just, you know, there's got to be a word that helps us to understand that disproportionate burden and privilege that women have. And I think kind of a pro-life feminism, you know, can get us there. But I can definitely understand why people don't find that appealing as well.
You know, Erica, it's interesting in this discussion of feminism and pro-life feminism and who we are. It feels like our world in 2021 has now thrown a new something else into the arena to mix it up and make it even more confusing. And that is this transgender and transgender rights. And all of a sudden, that's been thrown into the arena with all women. And now we're kind of having to pick apart that and say, no, being a biological woman is different than that. And it feels like now we have coming from us from another side is another argument we have to deflect on what it is to be a woman. Do you see that that is complicating this issue? And how is it getting addressed in your circles?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's one of sort of the saddest things I've seen come down the pike in terms of the children who are really I think being incredibly, well, in some situations, abused by being told that whatever their fleeting ideas are. I mean, I was a tomboy, so this all, you know, it makes sense to me that there are girls out there, maybe all of us here.
Yeah, I think so.
All of us are nodding.
You know, really interested in athletics and argumentation and tend to be more competitive and all sorts of things like that. You know, would I have been told that I was a boy growing up? Or, you know, is there a great, you know, a swath of different ways that women can live out their womanhood? And I think that's true too of men, you know, more artistic men, you know, men who, like my husband, love small children. You know, would he have been told that when he carried around his, you know, 12-year-old baby brother on his shoulder all summer that really he should have been, you know, he was really a woman internally? So, you know, those kinds of things are incredibly confusing, but destructive to these boys and girls' fertility, destructive to their bodies. So it's quite, you know, abhorrent, I would say. The part that's very good, though, is that you see, you know, radical feminists, at least, who are coming to see eye to eye with kind of social conservatives, Catholics, religious people on this issue. And one of the reasons for that is that things like Title IX, Title VII, these parts of the Civil Rights Act that are meant to protect women against sex discrimination because of their how they have different bodies and different reproductive capacities are being twisted all around, in part by this Supreme Court decision with, you know, the conservative Justice Gorsuch leading the way, which was terribly confusing to many of us. But what's really crazy is that what at least the Supreme Court does and what President Biden's new executive order does is they don't try to claim that trans identifying men, so those who call themselves trans women, which I won't call them, but I'll call them trans identifying men, that they're, you know, the Supreme Court decision doesn't really argue that they're women really, but that they want to take on the traits and actions of women. And so they're really just treating women as though they're kind of stereotypes that, you know, all the way in which those early sex discrimination statutes wanted to eradicate stereotypes, you know, to say that women didn't just have to be mothers. They could be lawyers and doctors and those kinds of things. They weren't only nurturing, but they could, you know, engage in rational discourse and those types of things. These are the things that are coming around now back to bite us, you know, that we're really only stereotypes. It's really only how we dress or whether we like pink or blue or whether we, you know, play with dolls or trucks as children. And so obviously the feminists are taking major issue with this. And of course, because of, you know, the possible, you know, the way in which these kinds of statutes could put and, you know, this executive order could put women in great harm's way in women only protected places, whether it's, you know, prisons or whether it's other types of spaces where women, you know, need to be nurtured because of past harm by men and that type of thing. So it's really, you know, I hope that there'll be a big backlash against the Biden administration for this and soon, because parents have got to see. I mean, just, you know, watching track athletes come out and male, you know, these trans identifying male really demolish women because of, you know, the testosterone that's blazing through their bodies. So we hope to see a real backlash, I think.
I hope so, because it's almost a narrowing of what women are versus a widening of what women are. And I have a very vested interest in this. I'm an Army helicopter pilot and I'm wearing Revlon fire red lipstick right now. So, I mean, there would have been a problem with me growing up. As we move forward, how do you think this is going to affect our view of family and of parenthood coming out of the COVID-19 situation? Because we've actually seen each other's. We've seen each other's families in very intimate settings as we've watched both women and men trying to juggle work and home commitments around crazy Zoom calls, around a lot of different competing variables. Do you think this is going to change? Do you think this will be where we are more focused on duty as family as we go forward? Are we still going to be stuck with that rights language as we go forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you've really put your finger on the, you know, catalyst, the potential catalyst for moving forward on a kind of pro-family policy that can get bipartisan support. because I think you see on both sides a desire to reorient the nation toward family life, toward kind of the communities that, you know, pick us all up that we need so much during this COVID time. And it is, I think, an orientation toward understanding that both men and women are really invested in the family or ought to be invested in the family, that it's not just women, that really great fathers want to, you know, see the work that they do outside the home as first and foremost for their families, especially when they have to be away from them. We've had a great situation where both of us, I've always worked from home, but my husband has worked from home this entire time. And it's been wonderful to see him kind of reintegrated into the life of our family even more than he was before, baking bread with my 2-year-old, you know, playing cards with the kids all the time, you know, these kinds of things that I think have been so good for all of us. So I hope that that's what's happening in other families. And I really do hope that, you know, there's going to be a lot of arguments I have with the Biden administration, but the fact that he wants to put forward, you know, an increase in the child tax credit and is hopefully going to be talking about the family allowance and trying to figure out ways, again, to reorient our very libertarian, individualistic country back toward, you know, the roots of the family, because that's where everything takes place, well, for good or ill. But we hope that by helping, you know, ease some financial burdens, that people will be able to spend more time on those things like, you know, cultivating virtue, cultivating good habits, those kinds of things that are really necessary for every political, economic, and civic good that we have together. And so I think that would be a really wonderful thing if it could come to pass.
I think a lot of people might feel coming out of this, and particularly those that have had the ability to work from home and spend more time with their family, with their kids, experiencing family life, that there's going to be some pushback too. And you kind of see it coming up in some news stories where big companies are looking at, well, we may not even need this much office space because there's a new way to work going forward. And so we might see that this rise up from us as the people saying, no, it's important that we have family and we have family time and that there's a proper balance in that. That might be one of the good things that we dig out of this COVID crisis that we're going through. And it'll be interesting to see. I also think, too, is that it gives men a lot of opportunities to see firsthand what it is that their wives do as mothers to their children. And that might actually bridge the gap even a little bit more, too, this understanding of what it is to raise a child up.
I think that's really true. One of the things that I trace in my book is some of the history. You know, it's a relatively new situation where we have, you know, women in the home caring for children and men outside the home, or both mothers and fathers outside the home, increasingly in our country and around the world, and leaving children at home. You know, prior to the Industrial Revolution, everybody was at home, you know, and in the agrarian setting, we really had both mothers and fathers engaged in different kinds of work in the home, but very much both toward kind of building up the family homestead, you know, and the family household together in a great interdependence. And so with industrialization sent, you know, the man out to be the wage earner, it brought on a lot of dependency in the woman's life that wasn't there before because they were very much interdependent. And so then, you know, you have the move of feminists who then say, in order to kind of have less dependency, more independence, we need to be earning wages as well. Well, wouldn't it be wonderful that this next giant revolution, the technological revolution, would bring much more work back into the home? And not all work can come back into the home for sure, but if we could bring a lot of work back into the home, we could hopefully start to see, you know, more family dinners, which are so important. You know, less commuting, which is important, I think, for the environment as well. More time together, building up family traditions, getting to know one another, not having kind of the hustle and bustle that gets everyone stressed and no one able to just be present to one another. You know, and of course, that means shutting off the technology and not having it, you know, in our hands all the time. It really means prioritizing those relationships. But that would be something so important for our nation. If we're going to move forward at all, we need to be kind of reconstituting ourselves as, you know, people in families, as responsible for one another. And I think if you see that again, you can start to see, I don't know, the rebuilding of kind of, you know, the unity that people want to see. It's only going to happen when those virtues are inculcated at a young age. You know, the virtues of generosity, of patience, of charity and understanding one another and the differences we have. We have to get, you know, sort of rub elbows together first to be able to sort of talk across political lines and that type of thing.
You wrote in an earlier article, it was about Ann Willard, and Ann Willard was the president of the Christian Temperance Union, right?
Frances Willard. Yeah, that's right.
Frances Willard. Okay. Frances, she was, and that was to keep drink. That was to stop drinking. And it was actually, I believe it was a Democrat supported organization that the temperance movement was. However, one of the things that you wrote that I thought was so poignant is about how this duty transforms us into better human beings. So the duty of parenting, of caring for children, of caring for senior parents, of caring for each other, it's that duty that transforms us and not necessarily the right. And I thought that was very, very poignant that you had written.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think it's, again, it's our relationships with one another and the obligations that we put ahead of. I mean, rights should be, rights are so sort of central to the American imagination, but they're really kind of necessary apparatus for fulfilling our duties. And it's really, if we understood rights that way, we'd kind of better contemplate and better recognize those, you know, interweaving, intersecting obligations we have to one another. Again, first and foremost in the family, but as, you know, as coworkers, as friends, as citizens, that really those kind of obligations we have to one another come first. And they very much call from out, you know, call us out of ourselves to be, you know, listening to, as, you know, we understand as Catholics, the needs of others far ahead of ourselves. And we can, you know, this was once our understanding as a nation, putting, you know, fellow, you know, citizen ahead of oneself. But I think it's only if we sort of if we understand, if we have a better understanding of rights and what rights are for, will we get to that, that, you know, that good, inspired nation once again.
There's all of us praying for that, Erica. We've been speaking with Erica Bakiaki, and she is from Harvard University, the Abigail Adams Institute, and also take a look at her work at the Wollstonecraft Project.
Erica, what's your new book that's coming out, and when is the book coming out?
It's called The Rights of Women, Reclaiming a Lost Vision, and it's out. It's available for pre-order, both at Notre Dame University Press and on Amazon, and I think Barnes & Noble, but it's out in July.
Great. Good. We look forward to talking to you about that book.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Erica, for joining us today. Michelle, always good to talk to you, too.
And always good.
We'll be back talking more issues of culture and faith on the next episode of Convergence. God bless.